And our special guest tonight, Philip Play. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, giving you an opportunity to chat with Phil. And in a moment, I'll be back with much more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Philip Plait, the Bad Astronomer, our guest. His website, by the way, is simply badastronomy.com. Philip, today they're talking again about going to the moon, setting up a base to be able to use it as a foothold so we can get to Mars. Do you like that plan, but do you think it's taking too long? They're talking about, what, 2020 to get back to the moon?
Yeah, this has got me pretty conflicted. There's so many things going on. It's such a complicated issue. President Bush basically got together with Mike Griffin, who is the head of NASA, the NASA administrator, and said, we need to go back to the moon, and we need to go to Mars, and we need to figure out how to do it. You know, when you're the chief of NASA and the president tells you to do something, you do it. The real problem here is that no extra money was given to NASA to do it. And so if you're told you have to do all this extra stuff, but you're not going to get any extra money, that means other things are going to suffer.
Right.
And so NASA has been going through some real problems right now, and they've been canceling a lot of science projects left and right. I was actually on one, a satellite mission, to do the education and public outreach for it, that is to create activities and such to teach kids about science. And it got canceled. And so we were pretty upset about that. And so, I mean, right away, going back to the moon and going on to Mars is already coming at a cost. But even if you know, more money were given to NASA, which is really the problem, but Congress just needs to come out and say, we want to fund this.
But you're not going to do it when you got a war in Iraq going on.
Well,
they just can't afford it.
That's a real problem. and, you know, a lot of people would argue that we're wasting that money in Iraq, and there's other money being wasted. Mm-hmm. There's a congressman who actually came out and said, look, we have money that is supposed to go to recovery efforts that is not being used, and it won't be used for quite some time. It's just basically sitting in a bank. Why aren't we using this to fund NASA? So, you know, I love that guy for saying it. And there's some other congressmen who have come out and said, yes, we need to, you know, we like the idea of going back to the moon, but we don't like it coming at the expense of science, so let's fund it. You know, personally, I've always been really interested in Apollo. I saw Apollo 15 lift off. I was a kid, and I was actually there. I saw it from just a few miles away, and boy, do I remember it. It was just amazing. And I was always interested in Apollo, but then a few years ago when I was researching the people who think that the moon landings are faked, I fell in love with moon exploration again. It really, of all the things to pique your interest about Apollo, it's actually researching the people who thought it was faked. I find that very funny. But I really got into it again.
And see, that's where you and Hoagland agree on something.
That's true. He has a very good debunking of the moon landing hoax on his.
Okay, list. I got it. I got the topic. You and Hoagland teamed up against Bart Sobrell and another guy who don't believe we went to the moon.
Oh God!
You got to say yes on that one.
I'd rather pull my own tonsils out by reaching into my throat. I've debated Bart Sobrell several times. And it's always a losing proposition.
Oh, you'll have Hoagland with you. He'll carry the ball.
Well, you know, you got to be careful. You know who you have on your side, because
this is détente, Philip.
Well, the reason Richard Hoagland is defending the moon landings is because he claims there are giant crystal buildings and such on the moon,
Who cares how we got there? As long as we got there, you know what I mean?
Oh, I do. I mean, if you know, if it were simply, you know, arguing about the moon hoax, that would be one thing. But, you know, it's going to come up
let you do your own hour by yourself.
On Enterprise mission, he does talk about the astronauts taking pictures of these things when it's, you know, I look at those pictures and I see internal reflections in the camera and other things like that. So
that would be a great show, though. That would be a phenomenal show.
But
don't rule it out.
staying on topic here.
Keep an open mind. All right. Anyway, back to the topic at hand. Going back to the moon.
Oh, gosh. I really want to see us go back. And NASA's taken the first step. It's building the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is going to launch in 2008. It's going to go to the moon. It's going to map the moon down to extremely high resolution, half a meter, 18-inch resolution on one of its cameras, I believe is what it is. And it's going to be really amazing. And I really do want to see humans going back to the moon. I've been reading books on what the moon can do for us, what the privatization of space can do, what NASA can do to help private companies like SpaceX and Burt Rutan's company, you know, get into space. And it seems like even if some of the pie-in-the-sky stuff doesn't work, like they talk about cheap nuclear fusion and things like that, it is possible to mine the moon and to create satellites. And in many ways, it's almost easier to go to the moon, build a colony, and then create solar-powered satellites and launch them into orbit around the Earth from the moon than it would be just to build them on the Earth and launch them in orbit in the first place.
Well, that's true. And eventually we'll probably do that. But, I mean, right now, I'm not sure the technology's there for that, is it?
We can't have the technology until we get pushed. You know, you don't have the technology to mine the lunar surface and get what you need out of it because we're not there.
Well, that's true. And if you look at the computers of the, you know, 60s and compare them to computers of today, look at the difference because we allow technology to grow.
That's right. And, I mean, even the computers, which were relatively simple, that guided the astronauts to the moon, were still huge. And they kept them back on Earth. They were so big they couldn't fit them on the rocket. So, they would use the calculations on Earth and then beam and send the results to the astronauts. And nowadays you can do that sort of thing on your Palm Pilot. And so, or your BlackBerry or whatever it is the kids these days are using. Probably an iPod has more memory in it than
Well, I'll tell you what's so strange, though, Philip. You know we've been to the moon. I know we've been to the moon. We're the first on the moon. We won the contest against the Russians, against the Soviets at the time. Now, there's another competitor, and it's the Chinese. And what's so bizarre is it's like a different contest all over again because there is that possibility that they could get to the moon before we can in this latest battle.
It's possible. Now, the Chinese, their space program is pretty young. It hasn't had a whole lot of successes yet. I mean, they just haven't had that many launches. And it's certainly possible that they could get to the moon in roughly 10 years. You know, when John Kennedy said, we're going to go to the moon, in 1961, I believe he made that
statement. 61, he made the statement, and we got there in 69.
That's right. We hadn't even had an astronaut in a suborbital flight yet. And so it seemed like, as I recall, I believe that's correct, Alan Shepard's flight wasn't until a couple of years later. Mm-hmm. And so it seemed insanity to think that we were going to go to the moon. And yet, look, July 20th, 1969, bang, Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon. So it's entirely feasible that you can do this in under a decade. But I think to do it, you'd have to have sort of the same plan the United States did, which was, you know, do this at all costs, just get there. The goal of the Apollo program was really to get there. And so once we got there, you know, there wasn't really a whole lot we could do. They studied the lunar surface, and there was a tremendous amount of science that we wound up getting out of that those missions. Don't get me wrong, but the Apollo missions weren't sustainable. It cost too much money every launch, and it was just there's no way you can set up a colony using the Apollo blueprints. It's what a lot of the private space guys call flags and footprints. That's all they could do was plant a flag and make their footprints and leave. We need to do something that's more sustainable, and I think NASA's trying to do that. I'm not a NASA insider. I have some friends who work there, of course, but I don't work for NASA, and so I don't know what's going on inside of there. I get the sense that nobody wants to talk about a new space race. And I don't know why. It seems like, you know, if we start screaming, the Chinese are going to the moon, it might get funded. But I get the impression that NASA doesn't want to do that. Maybe they don't want to race to the moon because in the end, it's not sustainable. It would just be like Apollo. It would cost a lot of money. We'd get there, and then it would be over again. And I'd hate to see that happen.
There's no question that we are moving toward this one world government, whether we like it or not. but the world is heading in that direction. Why aren't we simply teaming up with the Europeans, who have a pretty good space agency, get together with the technology, and get a man on the moon again, create a European-American base or a united front, and cut the costs down dramatically? I don't understand the stupidity why we're not doing that.
Well, the answer is typical. It's politics. When you look at what NASA does, it does partner with a lot of space agencies. I'm on a project called the Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope, or GLAST, and it has, I think, 7 different countries involved with it.
Everybody's paying money to it equally, or is it?
No, not equally. In fact, it's a joint project between NASA and the Department of Energy. But the Italians and the French and the Japanese, I'm not even sure who else is involved with it. I can never remember. But there are all these different countries involved with it. The International Space Station has a Japanese section, a Russian section. And, in fact, the Dawn mission, D-A-W-N, like Sunrise, to go to 2 asteroids, also had a heavy European component. NASA canceled that and really ticked off a lot of Europeans because of that. The problem right now is that some European scientists don't consider NASA to be reliable because they keep backing, well, the shuttle's not reliable.
Well, shuttle
clearly.
Did it right there, sure.
And then
right.
NASA canceled this mission that had European components in it. And, you know, that, as you can understand, they get a little ticked off. And so NASA's getting smacked around a little bit here, and they're hopefully, there's been a lot of troubles. I know that some of your guests, Bart Sabrell is one of them, and there are others who say that I'm just a lackey for NASA, just paid by them. This is not true, and anybody who reads my blog, as a matter of fact, I was very careful to put up on that Coast to Coast page I put up on my website tonight. If you go to badastronomy.com, there's a link at the top that goes to Coast to Coast. I have several entries in my blog where I'm putting NASA's feet to the fire, saying you cannot cut back on science. You can't do some of the stuff you're doing. And so part of the problem is, you know, NASA does, in fact, partner with the European Space Agency and the Japanese Space Agency and these other ones, but it's just not that simple. Getting together a big project like this is extremely difficult. Look at the space station. You know.
Oh, my God. I got to tell you, on the face of it, a waste of money.
I think it's even below the face of it. You're going to find very few scientists, especially astronomers and physicists and those types, who are going to say that the space station is worth anything. It was supposed to take a few years. It was supposed to cost $8 billion. It's going on, 15 years now? It's cost $100 billion.
It's not even finished.
It's not finished. The astronauts who are on board spend 90% of their time just maintaining it so that they can breathe.
I was going to say, trying to stay alive.
And so it's, you know, most scientists would say it's a colossal waste of money. And it's, you know,
you're going to find that it's really a huge ethnic restaurant. You're going to go up there and it's a Japanese restaurant. It's a Russian restaurant. It's got American cuisine and it's
got
various
departments. I've never heard anybody say it quite like that, but you may have a pretty good point. And it's funny because the space station has such promise. But it just, you know, it just turned into this huge political thing, and in the end, it just, you know, it couldn't be built the way it was supposed to be. And what I find really ironic is that when it was first proposed to Reagan, there were 3 designs for it, 2 of which were not any good at all, 1 of which was terrible. A 3rd made sense and could have been done for the right amount. The person who advocated that 3rd one was Mike Griffin, who is now the administrator of NASA. And what happened was, because of political reasons, one of the white elephant designs was picked, and Griffin lobbied against it and was kind of pushed aside by NASA. He left NASA, went into the private sector, but he was such a good engineer and such a solid guy when it came to making decisions about space travel. They picked him to be the head of NASA. And so now, ironically, he's stuck with this albatross around his neck at the space station.
And I think on the face of it, for him, he's done a pretty good job with what he's got to work with.
And, you're only as good as the tools you got, and the tools he's been given just aren't good. The shuttle is aging and was probably never a good idea once it was over-engineered for what it had to do. The space station isn't going so well. And my main worry, I think NASA can do this. I think that it is possible to go back to the moon, to build a colony there, to do this the right way. I think NASA can do it. I am very worried that it's going to become sort of this this congressional pork barrel project like the space station did, and it's going to be hugely bloated. And then there are going to be elections, and then the new congressmen are going to come in and say, why are you wasting all this money? NASA is actively seeking advice from a wide range of people. They're actually having a meeting in April of businessmen and astronauts and educational professionals, all kinds of people, to try to figure out how to do this correctly, how to lay the groundwork to go back to the moon and set it up eventually, maybe not for 50 years, but, you know, eventually, to go on to Mars, which I think is something we need to do. The question is how and when.
There's no question that I think we should discontinue the International Space Station and concentrate on a base on the moon. Spend our money there, spend our resources. Once we develop the proper way to get back there, it takes 3 days to get there from Earth?
You know, I was discussing this with a friend of mine who he and I run a bulletin board together, the Bad Astronomy Universe Today bulletin board. There are links there on my website, and we have thousands of people who have discussions about space and astronomy there. And he and I were talking about what to do about the space station, and you can't simply cancel it because there are thousands and thousands of people working on it, and you can't just fire those people, and you also can't just move them to a new project and say, okay, you're no longer working on, you know, the atmospheric module of the space station. You're now going to work on the atmospheric module of the lunar colony. It just doesn't work that way. And so you can't just cancel the space station. Plus, you know, Japan and the Soviet Union, the Russians, all these other countries, they are invested in this thing heavily. And if NASA were to say, you know what, we're pulling the plug, then why would these countries want to join us to build a colony on the moon? They'd have to be nuts to do that. So what I'm trying to think is maybe what NASA needs to do is to start moving management of the space station to private companies. Some of these companies are building rockets. Now, SpaceX is a small privately funded company that just launched a rocket, and the rocket failed, unfortunately. I don't know if the listeners know about this, but it launched from an island in the Pacific, and it got up to 25 seconds, and then there was a fuel line leak, and it crashed, which was unfortunate. But, you know, they're going to fix this problem, and they'll launch again, and they'll find another problem, and they'll fix that.
They'll launch again, yep, just like we did when we started our space program.
Exactly right. I mean, we had failure after failure, and eventually they'll figure this out. And I don't think it's going to take that long. I think 5 years from now, we will have civilian companies, small companies, routinely putting satellites into space.
Philip, what one scientific endeavor has been accomplished through the International Space Station? One experiment. Who
can't
knows?
Can't name me anything.
Neither can I.
Nope. There was originally going to be a telescope on board, but the thing shakes too much to put a telescope on it. And so that was an idea. I mean, there was a telescope on Skylab, for example, that did X-ray astronomy, looked at X-rays from the sun. But with the space station, it's, you know, I don't know.
Skylab was more efficient than this thing.
And it was, you know, the space station was going to be, was built a few years ago. Once things were not going so well for it, it was built as a laboratory for studying long-duration effects on people. And even that has now been cut way back because of the budget crunch with NASA.
Heck, that old Soviet clunker, the Mir, was better than this.
Oh, Mir did a lot of amazing stuff.
Yep.
And it certainly showed how to put together a big space station and keep it up. The Russians have always been very canny about this. They had many space stations for a long time, building up to Mir. And the International Space Station, again, you know, who knows, in 30 years, we could be shaking our heads saying, how could anybody have ever doubted it? Look
Absolutely.
At Hubble. Hubble cost billions of dollars and was a huge, you know, when the mirror was flawed at first, everybody made fun of it. Nobody remembers that now.
Best investment I've ever seen, the
yep.
Hubble. Do you believe in extraterrestrial life?
There's no evidence for it, but I think it's out there.
Let's talk about that when we come back. Our
sure.
guest, Philip Plait, on Coast to Coast AM. Filling in for Art Bell tonight. I'll do the same next Sunday. Kind of strange. I haven't said that in years. As a matter of fact, I haven't said that since I was doing my local show as the Nighthawk at KTRS in St. Louis, doing that show and then running down the hallway where the studio was already set up, our second studio set up to do Coast to Coast AM. Those were interesting times. Interesting indeed. I'll be back in a moment. I'll continue our discussion with the bad astronomer Philip Plait in the next hour. It'll be your turn, all things science on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Philip, astronomically speaking, tell us about the Sirius star system exactly.
Well, let's see. If you were to go out early in the evening these days, for those of you living in the northern hemisphere, after sunset and you face south, you will see a very bright star. And matter of fact, if you can find Orion, Orion's belt stars point right at it, and that is Sirius. It's the brightest apparent star in the night sky. It's actually a little bit more massive and hotter than the sun. It's about 9 light years away. So you're seeing it as it was 9 years ago, if you want to think of it that way. And it was discovered to have a companion star orbiting it, what's called a white dwarf. And this is a star that has roughly the same mass as the sun, but it's about the size of the Earth. It's sort of the dead, burnt-out core of the star. The sun will become a white dwarf in, 5 or 6 billion years, a long time from now. And so it orbits the main star in a highly elliptical orbit. I think right about now, it's actually they're pulling away from each other. And so if you have a telescope, you can actually spot it. It's hard because it's faint. I suspect I know where you're going with this, George.
Yes,
and
you do.
The Dogon tribe, Dogon, I don't know how it's pronounced.
Dogon, you were right.
I actually, I'm not terribly familiar with this legend, which is probably bad of me considering it really is this astronomical.
Oh, let me tell you what the legend is and then see if real science backs it up. What the Dogon tribe says was that there was another star system with Sirius, the star.
A third
and,
star.
Well, they didn't know about B at the time. And then they talked about C as a dwarf being there as well. And to the best of my knowledge, the tribe obviously could not see the binary star, the second one, with the naked eye, and surely you're not going to be able to see the dwarf. And so then some people said, well, wait a minute, missionaries had been there and they had talked to them about it.
That's
what
I
heard. But those missionaries didn't know about the B or C either at the time.
Well, I think the way I had read it is that they had already been worshiping that star, and because it is the brightest star in the sky, it's actually quite astonishing. It's especially when it's low on the horizon and the air is unsteady; it flickers and sparkles and changes colors. It's really beautiful. And so they either worshipped it or it was a mystical object for them. And evidently, right after the companion, the white dwarf, was discovered, there were some people who were traveling through that area. This is how I've heard it. I don't know how accurate this is. And so you can imagine that here you are, the quote-unquote civilized Westerner talking to these quote-unquote savages who worship Sirius, and you say, why, our scientists have just learned that it's orbited by another star, and they may have, you know, subsumed that legend into their, or that observation into their own legends. Honestly, I don't know. This isn't something I've studied very extensively. I know Carl Sagan wrote about it. I could probably dig it up. I've got some books here, but it would probably take me too long to figure that out.
Okay, if you read anything, read The Sirius Mystery by Robert Temple.
I've seen that.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. It goes into much more depth than what I'm talking with you about tonight. And it talks about how they described the extraterrestrials. They talk about their craft. They talked about the fact that the Dogon are in Western Africa, but they had come from descendants who were in a different part of the region, and it talked about how the extraterrestrials came down in that region, and it's just an incredible story. And to me, it just sounds like there was something way beyond just a belief system in a star.
Did they come from Sirius, or did they know about it?
Yes, they came from a planet in the Sirius star system, which I think revolved around the second star.
Well, even if it weren't a story about aliens visiting the Earth, which already sets all sorts of alarm bells off in my head, the Sirius system is not one where I would expect to find a habitable planet, because a white dwarf is a star that died. And to get it, you have to have a star like the Sun, and it it expands up to a red giant, and any nearby planets would be fried. And even worse, because it's orbiting another star, and I'd have to check the distances, it's possible that the two stars actually exchanged mass, that the star that we see as the big bright star may have been a smaller, dimmer star to start with, and then the other star dumped a lot of its mass onto it, and which caused it to gain mass and heat up. We see this happening a lot with double stars, with binary stars. And I'm not sure if Sirius did that or not. I can't say for sure, because I'd have to look up the numbers involved. But either way, whether it happened or not, it's an old enough system, but it's gone through a lot. One of the stars died, and so it's hard for me to imagine that a planet could be there. It's certainly possible.
But, what a great story, though.
But it's kind of a fun story, one way or another.
Do you believe, though, that the possibilities of intelligent extraterrestrial life could be out there somewhere?
Sure. Speaking of Sagan, he wrote a book. There was a Russian named I have a hard time pronouncing this, Shklovsky or something like that. They wrote a book. He wrote a book called Intelligent Life in the Universe, and Sagan basically co-wrote it with him, even though they never met. Sagan added almost as many words to it as there originally were, so it's a big, thick tome, and it's a fascinating book that starts with basically first principles, saying here's how stars form, and it goes through and talks about how you can generate planets and how civilizations could grow. And considering that this was before we knew of any planets orbiting other stars, the book is amazing. And you wind up calculating these numbers of how many planets there might be in the universe. And a lot of people don't have a sense of the scale of the universe. So let's just talk about the Milky Way galaxy. When you go out and look out at night and you see a few thousand stars, you're seeing relatively nearby stars that are a few dozen to a few hundred light years away. The galaxy itself is a flat, spiral-shaped pinwheel that is 100,000 light years across. So it's much, much larger than what we see of it. And we only see a small piece of it. It's like being in a smoke-filled room. And you can only see to your fingertips, when in fact the room is huge.
Yeah, why can't we see the huge room, though? Because it's just so spread out?
Because the galaxy is filled with dust. And it's a dust that's actually created in stars and blown out into the galaxy, and it blocks our view of it.
Okay.
So it is literally like being in a smoke-filled room.
If the dust wasn't there, what would the night sky look like?
It would be pretty fantastic. You would see many more stars. When the Milky Way rose over the horizon in the summer, it would be beyond imagining how beautiful it would be.
Would it light up the night?
I don't know. That's a really good question. It's probably shouldn't be too hard to calculate that. I'd have to pull out a pencil and paper and think about it.
Okay.
But you've made me think. I don't know. But it's possible it would be bright enough to read by, yeah. And you got to realize, too, the galaxy has 100 billion with a B stars in it, 10% of which are like the Sun. So there are probably 10 billion stars in our galaxy that are just like the Sun, about the same mass, about the same temperature. And up until 1995, we had no clue if there were any planets orbiting stars around stars like the Sun. We just didn't know. We thought so, but we didn't know. And now we're discovering them. And now there's well over 100 planets that have been discovered orbiting other stars. And so we now are starting to get an idea. This has changed from speculation to a science that's good enough to actually start doing statistics on it.
It's almost common, isn't it?
Yeah, it seems that planets are pretty easy to form around stars. And as a matter of fact, went back in my glory days when I was working on Hubble, we were observing young stars, and you could see the disk of material that the star was forming from. You could see what looked like the features of planets. You would see gaps in the disk. And if there's a planet forming near the star, it would sweep out a gap in the disk. Its gravity would attract the dust. And so you can imagine, like, running your finger down the sand, it leaves a groove in the disk. And so we see this happening all the time. And scientists, astronomers, are coming to the realization that there may be billions of planets in our galaxy. Now, the kind that we're discovering, the systems that we're discovering probably don't have Earth-like planets because the giant planets in the system disrupt the gravity of the system, and it would any Earth-like planet forming in it would actually get physically ejected from the system, which kind of sucks if you're trying to evolve life there. But, you know, even so, it does seem that planets form very easily. And so our solar system, while it may still be rare that these other weird solar systems are more common, the more solar systems you form, the more likely it is to form rare ones like us. So there could be millions of solar systems like ours in the galaxy. And we don't know how easy it is for life to form, but it seems that life formed on the Earth several times and was probably destroyed by meteor bombardment and all kinds of problems. But it kept forming over and over again. The basic building blocks of life can be found in comets, amino acids, which are what our DNA is built up out of, and things like that. And so it seems that that life can form easily. And so, you know, that's a guess because we only have one sample right now. But it just seems that when you look at these numbers and the way the trends are going, that there must be, statistically speaking, life in our galaxy. Now, whether that life is intelligent and not even intelligent, but technological. I mean, dolphins are intelligent, right? Whales are intelligent. Squid are intelligent, but they don't have fire. They don't have spaceships.
Well, you know, it's funny. The Dogon tribe says that the extraterrestrials were dolphin-like and they were aquatic, and they had arms, and I guess they had the ability to move. But they said that they were very bizarre-looking, intelligent creatures.
Well, one would imagine if you were to find a real alien, the process of evolution is what scientists call stochastic. It's random, and it just bounces around from whatever works to whatever works, and eventually you get this thing that looks like us. But when you look at what other animals are on the Earth, like the vampire squid is this bright red squid that is the weirdest freaking thing. I'd never seen one until I saw a special on Discovery Channel where they found one. And you look at all the weird things. You know, walking upright is not the best way to get around. And we have our head is up high, which is good because our sensory organs are up high and we can see farther and hear farther. And our brain is close to our sense organs, which is good because that means that we can process information from our eyes more quickly. But, you know, you think it's not very well protected. We've got this one tube that we breathe through and eat through. It's not the best design ever. And so you can think of better ways, other ways of having intelligent life come up. And so you can imagine when we come upon a planet, if we ever have interstellar travel and we go to this planet, will we even recognize that something is alive or intelligent? We may not even be able to look at something and say, yes, that's alive. Because it's so different. And, it makes me wonder, you know, you look at movies like Close Encounters or Independence Day or whatever.
Contact.
Contact was good because the alien was different. It looked like the astronomer's father because of his
special
mind.
And that was based on a Sagan story.
Oh, a really good novel called Contact.
Yep.
A really good novel. But his idea was that aliens had been around for billions of years and were so different. We couldn't even imagine what they're like. And I think Sagan was onto something. I think so. When we see aliens, you know, maybe we'll recognize them, but I'll tell you, they almost certainly won't be bipedal. Who knows? They may have evolved wheels or treads. Or, you know, who knows?
Or if they're really smart, they would have sent androids.
And that's the other thing. It's becoming clear, too, and a lot of science fiction writers are writing about this now, too, that it's much easier to send a robotic probe than it is a person.
Absolutely.
It's hard to imagine. Sending people to the moon is relatively easy compared to even going to Mars, which is a six-month trip. Going to another star would take thousands of years. And, you know, you could send a probe. You could accelerate it as fast as you want. You don't have to worry about radiation. You don't have to worry about acceleration. Just get it moving. And if it's smart enough, it could even self-replicate. Imagine a robot which has a plan that it would find a metallic asteroid in another system, build copies of itself, and then from there shoot off to the next nearest stars. So we can build one probe, but in you know, a few thousand years, there might be hundreds or thousands or millions of them.
And maybe also, Philip, they feed and they seed other planets. Maybe that's part of their mission.
It's possible, too. You know, Larry Niven, a science fiction writer, wrote about this, that we send probes to other planets, and if the planet itself has no life on it, it drops algae on the planet and seeds it, because they know that, you know, a million years from now, that'll be a habitable planet. It's amazing.
It's a good theory.
I like it, yeah.
The days in space are changing in that technology keeps changing. What do you think an Albert Einstein would have done today with the equipment and the ability to do things that he couldn't do back in his day?
That's an interesting question. Einstein did most of his calculations on, you know, with pencil and paper or on a blackboard. And a lot of theoretical physics is still done that way. My thesis advisor, when I got my PhD, actually had a stack of yellow tablets on his desk, and that's how he did his stuff. I was doing imagery from Hubble, so everything I did was online. But when we got the data set up and we would have to apply science to it, it was always pencil and paper for him. And so that, you know, I think that nowadays someone like Einstein can do some things better, because the equations can be solved mathematically by a computer. You can actually buy software that does it. I think the real advantage today of something like this is our ability to test these theories. Theoretical physics is always way ahead of observational physics, of experimental physics, because these guys come up with these wacky ideas, and then you have to build some, you know, $100 million machine to test it. But nowadays, and Einstein's an excellent example. I was at a planetarium show. I helped my group at Sonoma State University actually helped write a show about black holes. It's a planetarium show. It's showing at the Denver Museum right now. It's an awesome planetarium show. If any of the listeners are here or anywhere near Denver, go to the Denver Museum of Nature and Science and go see the show. The graphics are incredible. And I helped write one of the scenes, so it's really cool. My name's on the credits.
That is great.
And we showed it for some of the patrons, and one of them was asking me about relativity. They said, do we have any proof of relativity? And I said, we have hundreds of experiments which show that relativity is right. And most of them were way beyond anything that could have been done in Einstein's time. From particle physics experiments using accelerators to solid-state detectors that were just a dream back in the 1940s and 50s, observations of objects that were completely unknown in Einstein's time. And a lot of this is because of our advances in space science, in technology, in computers, and just the practical state of the art of just anything. As advances are made, we're able to do these things more and more. So, you know, if the next Einstein is contemplating the Big Bang and a possible metaverse, you know, it's like I said earlier, it could be that that as technology catches up, we can test theories more quickly than we used to be able to. And that's a very powerful tool, because when you have two or three competing theories, you really need the instrumentation to be able to distinguish between them.
Are scientists today, because of technology, smarter than Einstein was of his day?
I wouldn't say that they're smarter. The tools are better. You know, in many ways, you can say that a human living today is no smarter than a human living 20,000 years ago. On average, we're better educated, at least I hope we are, and our tools are better. You know, we can hunt with a rifle instead of a spear, and we can grow our food better, for example. But smarter? I'd say that we're just as smart, but, you know, Einstein doesn't come along too often.
No, not at all. Stay with us. Philip Plait will take your phone calls. I still want to talk with Philip about SETI, get his take on that. And also, of course, we had that caller during our very first hour who wanted to know if there's a way to stop global warming by putting up a huge diffuser in space to kind of block the sun. Let's get Philip's ideas on that, too, and then your phone calls. I'm George Norian for Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM.